You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
On this extended episode of Spoiled Fruit, Faith and Power, I speak with Mandy Cavoto, who, alongside her husband Matt, served on the worship staff at Mile High Vineyard in Denver. Mandy's story is one of deep courage and devastating consequences. When Mandy began to raise concerns about troubling dynamics in leadership, she was quickly labeled as emotional and accused of gossip. Instead of being heard, she was subjected to a disturbing process that required her to submit a list of all the people she was in contact with, grant permission for church leadership to speak with them, and even allow access to her therapist. It's a story that echoes a larger pattern we've uncovered throughout this series. Under Jay Pathick's leadership, individuals were often asked to expose their deepest trauma in the name of accountability. But when they naturally needed space to process that trauma, they were punished for it, labeled as gossips, branded as divisive, and quietly pushed out. This interview is another crucial piece in understanding the culture of control and spiritual bypass that has taken root at the highest levels of the Vineyard movement. Please note, this episode includes discussions of spiritual abuse and psychological manipulation. Listener discretion is advised. Here's my full conversation with Mandy Cavoto. All right, welcome to the podcast. If you could, tell folks who you are and what your connection with the Vineyard is.
Sure. My name's Mandy Cavoto. I was with Mile High Vineyard for probably around 7 years. I was on the worship team as a keyboard player. I auditioned for backup vocals, but I never got to actually do it. And my husband was one of the main worship leaders. He was on stage at one of their hubs almost every week. So.
Wow. Okay. So 7 years is a long time. That's almost, you know, getting close to a decade. And so for people who don't know, tell people what's significant about Mile High Vineyard specifically.
So I grew up in church and it was always some sort of crusty old white guy giving you a sermon from, you know, straight out of the Bible, which as a young 20 something, you're like, oh, this is boring. I can read this at home. What I really liked about the Vineyard was it felt a little bit more progressive. The longer we were in it, I think that probably wasn't as true as I thought it was, but everybody was younger. The musicians are really talented. I grew up in a family of musicians and I married one. So the fact that the music was so good was always nice. And then Jay Pathick specifically, he's a pretty charismatic guy. Like, I really liked the way he talked. He has a history or a background in philosophy. So he's kind of he's one of those like good apologists, right? Like he can sort of make you think in a way you hadn't thought before. And there was always, you always had some kind of emotional reaction, right? Like I think it was pretty rare to show up and just be like, well, this is a boring sermon and then eat your muffin and go home. So at the time that felt like something that was exciting and good and like, oh, God is doing something in me and all that. So that's what drew us to the Vineyard in the first place.
Yeah. So everybody who I've talked to who has encountered Jay at some point or another, they all kind of say the same thing like, hey, Jay's just a really nice guy. But then, you know, they always seem to have this other story, though, that kind of contradicts that a little bit, you know, at least that maybe perhaps he uses that nice guy sort of what's the word I'm looking for? Persona as a means to an end. Meaning like there's some ulterior motive there. So when did you start to first kind of question that and say, hey, something's not quite right here?
Well, it's funny. My mom also, I grew up in church under the piano that my mom was playing, right? So I've been part of church communities since I was in utero. And initially it was my mom. She wouldn't come with us. She's like, I can't listen to that guy talk. This is gross. But when we really started seeing it ourselves was when we had concerns about my husband's level of commitment versus we felt like the church was using him. He was on stage as much as, if not more than, the paid worship pastor, and we were not being paid at all. And so when we started bringing up concerns like, at least let us be at just one location, those kinds of things, and I would like to also be involved, like, the response that we got was pretty violent. And that's when you don't necessarily realize how gaslit you're being until it's been almost 10 years since we left. And I'm looking through these emails and I was like, oh my God, like, this is actually kind of scary, the things that they were saying to us. And knowing that the communication that I was trying to give to them was through approved channels, right? Like, I'm talking to other worship leaders. I'm not going to, like, congregants to sort of spread gossip. I'm like, I'm not doing well and I don't know what to do. And the response was not cool.
So it sounds like initially, like, you were just trying to engage with someone on staff and say, hey, like, I have these concerns, like, these are, you know, this is how I'm doing. And one would expect that the reaction would be like, hey, I'm really sorry, let's get you some help, or let's talk about this, or whatever. So what was kind of the response? Like, what were some of the examples that you received in return?
Yeah, that's one specific thing that happened. There was a woman, she wasn't on staff, but she was another one of the worship leaders. She was actually giving, like, lessons to the main worship pastor. And she asked, you know, how are you doing? And I just started crying, right? So then they're sort of asking probing questions because they legitimately care about you. And I found out later, I got a call from the worship pastor saying, we heard you've been speaking ill of us in the community. And I'm like, I don't even know what you're talking about. So I texted this girl and said, hey, did you tell them what we talked about? So she sent me an email saying, I did. These are the things that I mentioned. And it was like that I wanted to be more involved. You know, it was the conversation that we had. She didn't say anything inappropriate. And then I got an email from the executive pastor saying, you know, we had been talking about how you're hurt, but now you're hurting other people. And we're going to start switching this from conversations about how we can help you to, basically, she said, we're edging on church discipline. And she said, you're no longer invited to, we were invited to a worship leader event that happens in Cannon Beach. It was a regional worship event in Oregon. And she said, you're no longer invited to this because we're not sure that you can contain your emotions. And my husband, they were very clear, Matt is still invited. So you guys deal with that how you want, but we'll reimburse your costs so that you don't. They had to pay us like almost $1,000 for us to not go. And in the email, it said, you know, verbally processing is gossip. It's sinful. And confronting gossip and disrupting gossip is our job. This is what we do. So it puts you in a position where if something's going wrong, you're not allowed to say that. And then the woman that I had talked to said, she's like, oh yeah, anytime I have a conversation with somebody on the worship team, I report it back. Like, that was something that was sort of in her job description, was to report these conversations to leadership. And then when leadership gets them, this is what they did to me. I don't know what they did to other people.
Such an unusual response to someone who's just reaching out, you know, as you would, like, a, you know, I would expect my friends, if my friends were going through something like a hard time, you know, to feel safe enough to come to me with those types of problems, I wouldn't immediately jump to, hey, this is gossip or this is something negative. It's an interesting jump leap that they made there.
That's how I felt too. And yeah, they said, you know, that I had hurt other people on the worship team by having these conversations. So one of my best friends there was on the worship team. And I said, oh God, I've hurt Jason. So I went and talked to him and he looked at me like I had three heads. Like, I don't even remember you talking ill of it, much less it affecting me. So we're good. And then we got more emails that are like, you know, you're continuing to spread this around, which was strange to me because I had been instructed to talk to the people that I had wounded. And then when I did that, you know, they're like, you're still spreading gossip. It was a, like you said, very strange response.
Yeah, I've heard Jay speak and reference Matthew 18. Mm-hmm. It's also in their social media policy, if memory serves. They cite Matthew 18 and they like to cite Matthew 18, but They specifically, Jay seems to leverage that in terms of how to handle or engage with people who you are in conflict with.
Yeah.
One of the first things that he always seems to key in on, he sort of ignores the latter half, but the first half, what do you do when all else fails? You know, he leaves that part out. But the very first part, you know, exactly as you said, is, you know, before you take it public or take it to the church, you know, you take it to the person that you have disagreement with. And it sounds like that's all you were attempting to do, which is something that he presumably would support.
Right. Well, and I know, I knew at the time that I was emotional, right? It was very painful. So I actually talked to my husband, who's also on the leadership team, like, hey, should I approach this person or not? And he's like, yeah, they told you to. Like, also, you love this person. You know, this is your friend. If she's hurt by you, you should fix that. And then, yeah, it was... At the time, I felt like I had done something horribly wrong and I was hurting all these people. And, you know, it turns out actually none of them were hurt. They were having a normal response. Like, we care about you. We're going to try and help you. And the leadership was the one that had like the abnormally strange controlling response.
Yeah. And it would seem that like that would be a conversation or a circumstance or an incident that suddenly would make you feel probably, I would assume, like less safe to kind of share your feelings. Like now you're probably a little guarded and saying, thinking like, well, I can't really express how I'm really feeling now because this is just going to get reported back up the chain and I don't know what's going to happen at that point.
Yeah. And actually, it's kind of funny because I was reading through these emails knowing I was going to be talking to you. And I actually put that in email. Like, I no longer feel safe talking to you about any of this, because these were people that I trusted. The girl that wrote me that nasty email about, you know, our discipline or whatever, we had been friends for like 4 years at that point. We had babies together. She was the first person at the church that I met. And she wrote in one of the emails to me, she wrote like, she was intentionally harsh in her wording because she was trying to make some kind of point. I never quite understood what it was. And she never apologized for it. She said, I can't apologize for this because I was very prayerful when I wrote it. And when I actually went to Danielle Pathick, who is also on the leadership team at our church, I was told Jay doesn't do pastoral care. That's something that his wife handles. And I told her how I felt about that, that I felt like I had sort of stripped down for these people and shown them, this is who I am, this is where I hurt. And the response was violent, right? The church's response to that was, you don't get to use that kind of language. You can't say that you felt raped by the church. And I was like, great. What do I do then? Like, this is my community. These are people that I love, which is why we stayed, which is honestly a little bit humiliating that I stayed in an environment where people treated me that way. For 2 years after the initial incident, we tried to make it work because we were so heavily involved. And then being told, like, I intentionally went to someone who is in power and I told her, this is how I feel. I would never say these words to Becca because Becca's not going to, like, all that would do is hurt her. I'm not trying to say that, but this is how I feel. And we went to a meeting where Jay yelled at me for saying that. He's like, these people bleed on the road for you and you have the audacity to say that about them. And then when we did finally say, like, we're not going to be part of this church anymore. This is too painful. The response that we got from Jay was, you have agreed to say that we have not traumatized you. And if you speak ill of us in the community, we will directly and clearly combat that communication. Like, I have that. I read that email again this morning. So it was very much not a safe place for anybody who had any kind of struggle.
That is so bizarre. Such a strange... First of all, like, the whole situation seems like it kicked off simply because you were expressing some concerns and escalated to a degree that does... I mean, I'm sorry, but that doesn't sound like a pastor.
Right.
You know,
it
like trying...
It sounds like a cult leader.
Yeah, you can't say bad things about me or I'm going to squash you. Like, did he ever define what he meant by that? Like, he would combat that? Like, what does that mean?
I'm not sure, but I think, you know, we live in Wheat Ridge, which is just outside of Arvada. So a lot of the local churches are in Arvada. And I know that they knew, you know, there was like a community of pastors there. So when we did go to another church in that community, we were very careful with how we talked about why we were not with the Vineyard anymore, because I didn't know, my husband's a worship leader. I didn't want Jay saying things to our current pastor that would prevent my husband from being able to do the thing that I think he was put on this earth to do. So it was an interesting time for sure.
Yeah. So this is not, you know, obviously, you know, we talked about this before we started recording, not the first story that I have heard about ways in which Jay has acted that almost seem more akin to somebody who is the head of a mafia family than a pastor, and like sort of wielding power and making threats, you know, from sort of a PR perspective and trying to maintain this certain veneer. And so did you witness that? Did it make you start to think back to your time on staff, to other things that you had witnessed that maybe didn't involve you, and think, huh, maybe that wasn't cool either?
Yeah, it's interesting. One thing I forgot to mention is when we were going through all this, they told me that I had to have a list of people that I was allowed to speak to. So, you know, and they wanted to know who that was, and I had to give them permission to also be able to speak to that person to hear what I was saying about what had happened to us. And then on top of that, they requested access to my personal counselor to be able to hear what I was saying to him about what was going on at the church. Now, of course, my counselor's not going to allow that to happen. And I actually did draw a line in the sand, like, I'm not doing that. But they were very much trying to control this narrative. And they told me that this is because of what you've done. We're not being cultish and controlling. This is because you have broken boundaries. You have emoted, which is sinful. Therefore, we have to put these guards up to protect the rest of the community. Like, somehow the church community was at risk because of me having a problem. And, you know, there were other things that happened. Like, we went through their leadership training, which they called Equip, right? And basically your homework for Equip was to write out your history with authority or sort of confessing character flaws. And then you send it to somebody and they give you a report back. So I have a report where they literally give you a score in these three or four different areas. One of them was like character. One of them was finances. Like, are you a big giver? Another one was kingdom related stuff. Like how, I don't know what the word I'm thinking of, like how spiritually active are you or whatever. So I have like numbers, you know, that rank me. I'm sure they like had everybody's data saved somewhere. And, you know, looking back, that's a little bit sketchy. Like here, you know, that song Hozier did, Take Me to Church, where he goes, I'll tell you my sins so you can sharpen your knives. Like, that's kind of what it felt like. And then it was actually after all of this stuff had happened, they started this program called Faith Walking. And I don't mean to trash faith walking. The guy who started it is a wonderful human. He actually worked with me a little bit. And he's like, maybe you shouldn't be doing this because of where you're at and like what has happened to you. So maybe back off a little. But it was basically, the idea of it was to go through your life and dig up trauma. Like, what vows have you made? Like, I will, my vow now, I will never walk into a Vineyard church again, right? And why did you make them? And then as this trauma comes up, you process it with somebody on staff at the Vineyard. And so they're helping you process your trauma, which looking back feels like when we said you traumatized us, right? Their response was, no, no, no. We're interacting with your old trauma. You know, your dad, that stuff with your dad, that's why you feel this bad. It's not because of what we did. It's because you're passing the bill. And they would do this. They'd slide their hand across the table like you're at a restaurant. You're passing the bill to me for what your dad did, right? And I'm like, yeah, okay, I get it. I get what you're saying. And some of it, that's the thing. It's like, it might be true. Maybe it hurt more because I also was rejected by my own father as an adult. But that doesn't, don't throw that in my face. You know what that did to me. Because I told you.
it just reeks of like sort of pseudo psychology too. It's like, who are you and what qualifications do you have to even make that judgment?
Right. And honestly, like, you know, some of the people that I was in this little group with, they're like, I was traumatized when I was in college when my roommate moved away, you know, and you're like, okay, great. I'm glad for you that that's your only trauma. So I think, you know, if you're dealing with people who have had healthy childhoods and relationships and all that, like this maybe isn't that damaging. But when I did talk to my counselor about it, he was like, he was one of the ones that people would get referred to by the Vineyard. And he's like, what are you guys doing over there? Like, this is really dangerous. Like, you should not under any circumstances probably be digging for trauma anyway, because it's going to come up when it comes up and you don't go digging because you're not ready to deal with it yet. But if you're going to go digging, you need a professional licensed psychologist to help you work through it, not some philosophy major who thinks he's a big deal, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's kind of like one of those things where, you know, there's been instances over and over again that, you know, I've witnessed, that I've been told, where there seems to be a very muddy line between what would be considered pastoral care and where the pastor needs to hand it off to somebody who is a licensed therapist.
Yes. And I think in some ways, I will say the Vineyard did that. I have some mental health issues. And when we got to a point with my friend Becca, who wrote that nasty email to me, she was like, I don't know how to help you. You need to see someone. That's how I ended up at Mark's anyway. So that's, you know, in some cases, they did that well. But honestly, that was really early on. We left the Vineyard in 2017, I think. And that was like 2011 that happened. So it was, there was kind of a shift, I think, as it started growing, they started making more hubs. Then you started seeing a lot of pressure on the worship teams in particular, because they didn't have enough worship teams to fill in all of the hubs that they were creating. And that's when things started to really get hard, was when the growth got so big.
Yeah. And it's interesting too, because one of the things I've noticed is that, you know, modern day Vineyard anyway, seems very hellbent on presenting a certain image and sort of pitching a certain product. And part of that product package is definitely the music part of it. And so I can see where, you know, if it's not fulfilling the standards that they've set, that's gonna not be okay.
Right. Right. And if you're a gifted musician, they're going to overstrain you, which is what we saw. Like, we were part of the Arvada Vineyard, and my husband told them, I will only perform at the Arvada Vineyard, because we wanted to be part of the church group, right? We weren't really there for performing. We wanted to be part of the community. But they continued to put him in Westminster, in Lakewood, and all these other places, which is really hard on me because I've got two little kids. I don't want to be going to church where I don't know anybody. But I also want to hear my husband sing. I don't want us to be separated on Sunday mornings. So, those were the little things that were sort of stacking up that were making us feel like we're being used here. And in the course of my husband leading worship probably 3 times a month or more for 7 years, we got a dinner. They bought us dinner one time for that. And he was also, you know, that means practice during the week, too. You've got Wednesday night practices. You've got mentoring all of the people underneath you. People were shocked. They're like, oh, I didn't know Matt wasn't on staff, because he was on stage as much as the worship leader was, the pastor.
Yeah, that's interesting, because it's funny. There's a memo, an internal memo that went out in 2020 that sort of outlined, it was, I'm not sure entirely who it was authored by, but someone on the national level put it together. And it was their perceived issues with the Vineyard and the things standing in between the Vineyard movement today and their ability to continue to grow and be a church planting movement. And one of the things they cite in there is the fact that, you know, a lot of the national level positions weren't paid.
Yeah.
You know, so the irony there is kind of like, well, okay, but what about the people on the local level, you know?
Right. Yeah, I mean, they had, I think, 4 hubs. It's like 4 different locations and 1 paid worship pastor. So even if you So she would do, you know, one location a month. She would go to one. Then you don't even have a consistent worship pastor. And it's putting strain on all of the musicians as well. Like, I think there was one hub that had one bass player. They're not paid either, but they're having to go twice a week to play bass because nobody else can play bass.
So talk a little bit about, you know, your hindsight is always 20/20, but I'm sure you've done a lot of reflecting back on your time there. And what are some of the other things that you noticed about leadership there? Specifically because you're not just at any Vineyard church.
Right.
You're at the National Director's Church.
Right.
Who has been sort of handpicked. You know, he sort of apprenticed under Rich Nathan, who is a huge name in Vineyard. He co-founded Vineyard Columbus, which is now the flagship church now that Anaheim is gone. And was sort of like born and raised, so to speak, under that umbrella.
Yeah.
And was sent out to plant this church and then obviously ascended up the ranks. And so talk about, you know, some of the things that you witnessed, you know, looking back now.
You know, it's interesting because I grew up listening to sort of traditional sermons, and these are men that are typically trained at seminaries. They're very sound in their biblical knowledge and that kind of thing. And so sometimes the sermons are pretty dry, right? And you're like, okay, yeah, that's the parable, whatever. The thing about Jay, looking back, it felt like his goal was to solicit a response. It wasn't necessarily about preaching the truth or preaching the gospel. It was about, it almost felt like emotional manipulation. Like if he didn't make half the room cry, he didn't succeed. And he loved talking about trauma, right? He would talk about bubbles, like these bubbles of trauma that surface, and he loved it. He specifically talked about enjoying, like, provoking things in people to make them sort of deal with their stuff, which feels, looking back, that feels really gross. Like, I've been in other churches where I have noticed the pastor see me crying and they come and talk to you afterward. Like, what happened? Are you all right? I don't understand. Like, are you all right? Right? Not this, like, proud of themselves. Look, I've elicited a response. And so we were talking earlier, my mom wouldn't come. She would come if my husband was singing, and then she got to where she couldn't even do that, because having grown up in the church and having seen some sort of cultish behaviors happen, she was like, I can't listen to these sermons. This is too much.
Yeah, and it seems like, I mean, and this is just obviously me speculating at this point, but it seems like when you are trying to elicit a response, that there's probably some sort of call to action attached to that, like, you know, some movement or something that they kind of want you to take part in, and not just having an emotional response. It feels like there's something probably paired with that.
Yeah, I think, like, I'm not sure exactly what the goal was, to be honest, but just judging from the emails that we received from them, it felt like a control mechanism. Like, if I can make you see your trauma, then I can blame that when I do something wrong. And the avoidance of accountability was pretty intense. What was a little bit surprising to me was, you know, the woman that wrote that email to me never apologized. She was very clear that I think this was right. I got yelled at for saying that it hurt me, right? And then when I spoke to Annabeth Morgan, the worship pastor, a year or two later, she says, oh, if she could go back and not send that email, I know that she would. And I'm like, well, that was never communicated to me. So the only sense I could make of that was that she was told, you're not allowed to apologize for this. It felt very much like Jay put the guardrails up. This is my reputation, and we're going to stand by what we do here, and we're not going to let my reputation be damaged. Kavodos be damned, right?
Yeah.
And in all of these letters, they're like, oh, and, you know, we love the Kavodos. We love you. We appreciate you. We see what God is doing. It's like every time you're hurt, they're like, oh, we see what God is doing in you. God is working something good in you. But then, you know, they say they love you, but when things go south, that's not what you're actually receiving. So then it's like you're being, the gaslighting is kind of impressive. Like, I know that's a really common term, but it's like, you don't get to say that you love me and then also tell me I'm not invited to these things until you can see, as I forget how she worded it, but like, we need to see the fruit of how you're choosing to change. Like, well, that's not loving somebody. I don't think you understand the concept of what it means to love somebody. So we love you, but in order to be welcome in rooms you used to be welcome in, you need to change and we need to see that you're changing.
Yeah, and to go back to the root of it all, too, it's like, who made you the arbiter of who gets to decide who's in the right and who's in the wrong here, or if anybody's in the wrong,
right,
for that matter? Like, it seems to me that, like, it's just a situation where there's one person kind of confessing how they're feeling to the other person, just looking for some support. Like, that's basic ministry, in my opinion.
Yeah, well, and what's really crazy about that whole situation was I talked to Abby, who talked to Annabeth, who talked to Becca, who sent me a nasty email.
But right? You're the one spreading rumors?
Right, exactly. That's exactly right. And then when I talked to Danielle and said, this is, you know, I feel like I have been violated, emotionally violated by you people. She, and I told her I would never say this to Becca. And then in a meeting with Jay and Becca, Jay said, Mandy says she's been violated emotionally by Becca. Right. And I'm like, hold on. How am I the one spreading rumors when I specifically told Danielle I would not say these words to Becca because I don't want to hurt her? But somehow Jay finds out that I said that and says it to me in front of Becca. But I'm the one that's being accused of being a gossip and causing pain and division within the church.
Sounds like they could do with some mediation training, you know?
Yeah. Or maybe just general training on, like, being a counselor. I think the only person they had on staff that had any of that kind of training was Corey. And he's not there anymore, but he was great. Like, he knew how to deal with emotionally traumatized people, which, you know, at the time I didn't realize how traumatic it was to be in a situation where your dad writes you an email telling you he doesn't want to be your dad anymore, right? But having a pastor leverage that against you in email, can we talk about the irony of this? It's really not okay. Like, these are the kinds of things where maybe if everybody in their church was happy and the saddest thing that ever happened to them was their friend moved away, they would be fine pastors. I don't know, but I can tell you that they have no concept on how to deal with people who have experienced legitimate trauma outside of church, but they're happy to leverage that trauma to excuse their own poor behavior.
And it sort of sounds like they just don't want to deal with it either.
Right. Yeah. That you go deal with your shit, right? Like, we'll send you to a guy and then we're going to ask for you to let us talk to him so we know what you're saying about us. But we didn't do anything. Yeah. It's not us. It's that. So you go to your guy and deal with your stuff. And right, we're just going to sit over here and do our thing.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
I'm glad you brought that up again, because I meant to ask you, what was your response to them when they said, give us a list of all the people that you talked to?
Yeah, that's when things, I started to realize this is not, something is not right here. And that's when the word cult kept sort of popping into my brain. When they're saying who you are and are not allowed to talk to, that's a problem. We were supposed to have this meeting with Jay. He actually wanted to record it so that I wouldn't misinterpret the things that they had said to me. I almost wish I would have done it. But that's when they started saying things like, we want access to your counselor, we want to record this meeting, and we want you to tell us who you're going to talk to and give us permission to talk to them. That's when I thought, we're done. Like, I, over something that honestly was pretty small, like, I'm feeling a certain kind of way. They could have just sat me down and said, we're really sorry that you feel overlooked. We love Matt, but we love you too. How can we fix this? And we wouldn't be having this conversation right now. And I wouldn't be terrified to walk into a church. I had a panic attack on Easter because we were going to go to a new church
and I couldn't go. I used to feel safe in church. I used to love church. Church was like, I like singing, right? I love the music. And I can't even, you know, I got a text from a coworker that said he has risen. And my response is like, screw you, dude. And, you know, I hate to say that, like, I've sort of deconstructed my own faith on a logical level too, but I wish there wasn't all this oomph behind it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, man. And I know I, you know, people can't see what I can see, you know,
right. Obviously.
And so, like, I just want to honor the fact that, like, and not just you too, like, it's been, unfortunately, quite a few people who have come on to take part in this project too. It very clearly, like you just mentioned, that it's been over a decade. You know, same thing with like the Ken Wilsons out there and the Chris Sauters and folks who, you know, the damage was done, you know, potentially years ago, but it obviously is still very, very painful and the wounds are still very much there. So what, I mean, I guess the big question for you and for a lot of these folks is, what do you hope for in all of this? Like, what do you hope that we can achieve through shining a light on some of this behavior?
You know, it's funny, on a really selfish note. Well, I mean, my mom, she lost her husband last year, and she's been on sort of a journey of discovering a new level of faith, right? Because losing your husband is obviously no fun. And she said that she's been praying pretty much since that incident on Easter that I would have an outlet to be able to heal from this. Like, what, a month later, I get a text saying, hey, will you talk to this guy about your experience in the vineyard? So if I'm being really honest and really selfish, just having somebody like you look at these emails and go, that's weird. Like, A, it's not a pastor. B, it sounds like a mafia boss. Like, the thing that happened to you is real. I see it and I care. That's a big deal just on a for me personally. And I know that's probably why you're doing this. I hope that if, and I know there are other people, we were in the church, right? If other people can have the same sort of cathartic, like, yeah, this happened to me and it was real, that's fantastic. What really scares me is having Jay in a position of leadership like this, where, you know, these small churches can say, hey, man, we don't like what you're doing. And he's just like, cool, leave the vineyard. It's probably honestly better for those churches not to be affiliated with him. But in a perfect world, right, the vineyard would have people in leadership that know how to do pastoral care, that have experience with counseling and training in it. People who don't wield power to manage their own reputation, where they care, like, they care more about their reputation in the community than the health of their congregants. So I think the vineyard has a lot to account for, and I hope that they do it. I don't think they will. I would be absolutely shocked if Jay releases power of his own free will. Maybe if it gives somebody else, like, oh my God, like the lenses, right? Where you take the rose-colored glasses off and you go, that guy wanted access to my counselor? That's not okay. Like, that's illegal. And, you know, my counselor told me I had drawn the line, but he said I wouldn't do it anyway. Like, you can give me permission all you want, but I'm not doing it. So I think I would really like to see Jay step down. But I don't think he's going to. And I would like to see people like me see that the people who have hurt them are called to account. Like, you don't get to do this. This is not God. This is not, you know, whatever verse it was, your Mark 18 or whatever, Matthew 18. This is not how we do this.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny, not funny, haha, but, you know. Yeah. Sort of like ironic. I was talking to somebody about this, probably one of the folks from Duluth, where I said, you know, Vineyard had an opportunity, nationally speaking, to really be a pioneer in a way that honestly would have made them look really good coming out of a horrible situation where all they had to do is humble themselves enough to say, we screwed this up royally. And then, like, brought in, you know, like a Grace or somebody like that, and taking the good, the bad, and the ugly, essentially like what Duluth did as an individual church, where they're like, look, we know this is going to suck, like, for us, but, like, it can't possibly compare to what happened to these poor victims. And so we're gonna eat this one because that's the right thing to do. And they've even said that about the civil lawsuits. They're like, we're gonna lose this, and we should.
Yeah.
Because we screwed up. And if that's part of the healing process, so be it. That's what needs to happen then.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because that's what they asked us to do, right? We're supposed to sit in rooms where they tell us you're a gossip. I have a report telling me that, you know, I have an anger problem or whatever. And I'm supposed to sit there and take it on the chin and hear the feedback and grow and respond. But any feedback that they get, they don't want to hear it.
Yeah. Did they ever, I meant to ask you this too, the unusual quiz, I think, that they made you take, did they ever provide you with any kind of rubric or like understanding of like how this grading system even works, or like how do they come up with these different numbers?
No, but that's a good question. I should have asked.
Yeah. Like how
like
are
you a quality student? Give me the rubric so I can get an A.
Well, it's kind of like, you know, if I take a personality test, I want to know like how is this being graded, or how are they coming up with these answers? You know, I want to understand what the mechanism behind it.
Right.
And like, it just sounds otherwise it could be something that somebody arbitrarily came up with. And I'm like, this may be complete and utter bullshit. You know, like,
and
how
it
do
wasn't
I know?
Even somebody on staff. So you get assigned. So I was under Annabeth because my husband was in the worship team. So she assigned us little mentors that were, I don't even know, but the lady that did my assessment was not on staff. So she's just one of the core leaders of the church.
So, bizarre. It's kind of like they did this. I started looking at this. They did this assessment. They brought in somebody who they were like, oh, this person's got, they're a professor. They've got a PhD, you know, that specializes in sort of surveys and analysis and all this stuff. And they conducted the survey that they sort of used that as one of the things they leveraged to kind of push through all these changes at the national level.
Okay.
And I'm like looking through this survey and I'm like, man, that's a really low response rate to begin with. But then as I started to dig into it, the more I dug into it, the more I thought, this there's a lot of flaws in this survey. And I'm like, how can anyone worth their salt who has a PhD in this actually think and tote this as a accurate or effective survey that actually has concrete results that we can actually say, hey, like leverage these results to say, hey, we have issues with X, Y, and Z. Like, this survey is junk.
Yeah.
And so like, again, it's one of those things where it seems like they leverage things that may or may not be credible to ultimately get to where they wanted to go to begin with.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all, right? The kind of person that says, tell me who you're going to talk to so I can make sure I know what you're saying, is not the kind of person that gets an actual assessment where they let people say things that maybe they don't want to hear.
And if you're doing the right thing to begin with, then why are you so concerned about what someone's going to say?
Right. Well, that's like doing this podcast, right? I am hearing that a lot of people are nervous to go on record. And I'm like, why? Like, I know what I'm telling you is 100% the truth. I can show you emails that I've gotten from them that demonstrate what I'm talking about. Like, I feel like if you're not afraid of what you've done, then you, like, let me give you an example. I coach a team. And one year, the people who are in charge of the organization I work at, they sent out a survey to my teacher or my parents, the parents of the kids that I teach. I was not afraid at all. I don't know what was in the survey. I think it was like, what's the instructor's response time? Do your kids feel safe when they leave or whatever? And I'm like, yes, please do that. Because as an instructor in charge of children, right, if I'm hurting them, I would like to know. Yes, I'm going to go cry in my bathroom and maybe throw up a little bit. But at the end of the day, I give more a shit about these 10-year-old kids than I do about my reputation. And so if I am hurting them, I don't want to do that anymore. Like, these are kids. And I know how difficult words from adults can affect children. I don't want to be dishing those out. So I don't, that's why this whole thing is really hard for me, because I'm, and this is why I have like the exact temperament that the Vineyard is looking for, because my goal, I want to be good, right? I want not like to get in, not to win some special prize, but like, I want to do it right. I want to be good. I want God or whatever to be proud of me. And so I hear all this feedback and I take it and I believe it,
because I want to be good. And so I know how hard it is when you're trying that hard to be good and they tell you you're not. And you're not only not good, but you're not even welcome anymore. But we love you. We love you, though.
Right. Yeah. And it's like, and for somebody who is striving for that level of acceptance, you know, someone telling you, hey, you're not quite meeting that bar just makes you want to like work even harder, you know? Yep.
Yeah, it's gross. It was really, really hard reading through the emails to make sure that I was communicating to you accurately. And seeing, like, I would say something, I'm like, well, I'm not trying to cause problems. You know, I don't mean to make a division. This is just where, you know, like, but I'm not okay. Like, I think I have an email where I said, I'm not trying to be divisive. I don't know what to do. I'm not okay. And it's really hard to look at that and see, like, I let them make me think that I was the problem. And I will have to live with that shame for the rest of my life, that I let them do that to me. And so if I can keep anyone from feeling the way that I feel about this, like, I'm a smart gal. I work in engineering. Like, I know how to, you know, like, I'm not some dumb, impressionable dolt. And somehow I still got into this situation where, like, I honest to God thought I am hurting people in the church. Like, I have hurt my friends. And now I'm not, you know, like, it's crazy to me that this happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
And 40-year-old me feels really, really sad for 30-year-old me that I let this happen.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. I can't help but think back. So my other podcast that I've been doing for about 10 years, The Deconstructionist, one of the guests that we had on early on is a guy who is a cult expert. And Dr. Steve Hassan, and he's a fascinating guy and has some a few books out now that are absolutely phenomenal and very, very useful and helpful. But one of them, his first book, Combating Mind Control, has a really interesting section where he talks about the fact that, hey, like, you know, a lot of people who get sucked into cults, because he himself, the man has a PhD now and joined the Moonies back in the day. You know?
Okay.
And so he makes this point in the book that to say, hey, like, all sorts of people get sucked into these types of things. Like, people, you assume that it's just, oh, this stupid person who just wants to be loved or belong or whatever, but it's not, that's not the case at all. He was drawn in, like, while he was attending college. He was at university, and they had, you know, a couple girls go out and meet with him, and you know, they kind of sort of tricked him into going to this talk or whatever. And then before he knows it, you know, he's in this cult. And
yeah.
So the point he's trying to make is, look, like, it can be literally anyone. It doesn't matter. It has nothing to do with your intelligence level or your socioeconomic background, like, has nothing to do with that. And I'm not saying that, by the way, that Vineyard is a cult.
Right.
But,
no,
but, yeah. Because, you know, again, it is very individual on the local level, because local churches are autonomous. So you can have a very different experience at one than the other.
For sure. Yeah.
But when we're talking about the national arm and we're talking about Jay Pathak and his leadership, there are stories that have come out now, including your own, that sort of lean towards a very authoritarian sort of hand and leaning towards cult-like behavior. And if there aren't checks and balances, and I even said, and this will come out later, but I thought I would be helpful. And so I used to write legal documents for one of the largest banks in the world. I used to be a business analyst, and I would write procedures and things for a department within the bank. So, not new to me at all, not my first rodeo writing legal documents. And so I thought, hey, you know, they keep saying how hard this is and how it takes time. And so I thought, I will help them out. And so I looked at the suggestions and recommendations made by the Guidepost Report, the Grace Report, and a lot of them are similar. And so even though the Guidepost Report was supposed to be not necessarily focused towards victims or any specific incident, it was more of an institutional assessment, a lot of similar findings, a lot of similar recommendations. And so they are still lacking a lot of policies that would make me, as a congregant, somebody attending their church, feel very unsafe still.
Yeah.
The one good thing that they have done is they have implemented a child safety policy, which is a very well-written document, provides protections that they should have had probably before now, but hey, better late than never.
Yeah.
Right. What they're still lacking, though, is a true nepotism policy that isn't full of loopholes.
Right.
You know, what they're also lacking are whistleblower protections. So for people who do report on bad behavior, they're not going to be facing repercussions of retaliation from somebody.
You mean like the email where we were threatened?
Yes.
Precisely. I mean, they didn't even, they were clearly, the thing that's scary is he put it in writing. Like, they're so okay with that they were willing to put it in an email that, I mean, I didn't save it on purpose. Yeah. I just have it because I didn't delete it. You know what I mean? It's like, all I did was log into my old Gmail account. And I'm like, oh, look, here it is.
That's what's remarkable to me is that a lot of these conversations, I mean, if you look on Duluth's website too, they've, to their credit, posted everything. And so there are a lot of internal emails between, like, John Clewer, who's the interim pastor there, and like Rob Morgan, the managing director at the national level.
Okay.
That, I mean, they put everything out there and it's in print. So they can't dispute certain conversations that were had because they're right there in black and white.
Right.
But they don't have any kind of whistleblower protections. But first and foremost, they still don't have a true third-party reporting hotline.
Ugh.
They set one up. It does go to Guidepost, but Guidepost then forwards it back to the national arm, who oftentimes will then forward it back to the very pastor that you reported in the first place.
On.
That is not safe. It is not third party. And so I also wrote them up a job description for an HR person that they desperately need. But then I admit, you know, in talking to some of the other pastors, like they acknowledge, like, look, you know, the local pastors, because the movement is so large now, probably do need to give up some of the autonomy that they've enjoyed. They have to give up a little power so that way there's checks and balances there. But in order for that ever to be a feasible thing, the national arm also has to have checks and balances in place, which they do not. So I rewrote their bylaws that gives the local churches a voice. They will vote on the national director instead of somebody appointing them.
Oh, that's nice.
I put in term limits and terms and annual reviews and a system of checks and balances. So that way, if somebody like a Jay Pathick is found to be abusing his power, there are steps that they can take to remove that person or at least discipline that individual.
Right.
And so I plan on putting all of this on my website and saying, here you go. You can have it.
Yeah, I did this for free. You're welcome.
Yeah. And you, by the way, you don't have to use the exact one I use, but here's at least a template by which you could easily within an afternoon or less, you know, tweak it. And I wrote it from the perspective of Vineyard. So it's in Vineyard's terminology, language, all that good stuff. But it would implement policies and rules that would instantly provide protections and policies that would prevent the very environment that has allowed these types of things, these abuses to happen on a wide rate. Because obviously, as you said, like there's emotional and spiritual abuse that is obviously quite rampant because you're not the first person I've talked to.
Right. Well, and I mean, we were going through this in groups. You know what I mean? Like that faith walking thing, there was like, I don't remember, 15, 30 people going through it. I think what's scary to me is how many of them are still in it. How many people are having their trauma leveraged against them and not even realizing it. It's like how many other people are writing emails like, I'm really sorry that I'm not okay, but like, I need help, right? Like, it's scary.
Yeah. And you know, like we talked about before we started recording, you know, there are a large number of people who I've interacted with and spoken with who provided me some pretty horrific, heartbreaking stories who just like couldn't go on record for one reason or another. And I completely respect that.
Yeah.
Not wanting to put yourself out there. And so and those are just the people that even agreed to even talk to me on the phone, much less the people who aren't even brave enough to even like reach out to me. Not to say that they're not brave, but like are in a situation where it's just not a reasonable expectation for them. So how many other stories are out there?
Right.
You know,
or how many people, like we didn't leave. Like my husband and I were talking about this before we started recording. Like we could have just left. Like we were just in it a little bit too deep and we were really worried that we would lose all of our friendships, which we did. I have one friend left. And so I totally understand. Like I'm out of church now. So I have no, there is no repercussion that the vineyard can do, except maybe like I might get some text messages. But I really feel for people who, well, I'm proud of people who got those emails and were like, screw you, I'm done. This is not church. Goodbye. And then there's the people who are worried about repercussions. And then there's people that are still in it, right? And it's even people, I have a friend who's still at the vineyard, and she, I told her a little, like a little snippet of what had happened to me. And she's like, well, that's why I don't get involved. Like, I just show up on Sundays and we go to church and have a nice time, but I don't want to be in the politics because this is what happens.
But so. you vote with your feet, as they say.
Right.
There is some complicity in continuing to show up at a place that behaves in such a way. It's just like, you know, they aren't going to listen until you affect them in the place where they're really, where they have the power, which is the money aspect of it. And it's been pretty clear that they only give a shit about the churches who wield that amount of power. As you know, like every church has to give 3% tithe to the national office. And obviously the bigger your church is and the more people who are giving, the more money that the national arm is getting. And so the bigger churches automatically have the bigger, you know, vote. So to speak. And so, you know, there is a way to hold them accountable. You know?
Right.
It's, you know, one easy way to hold them accountable is to stop showing up.
Yeah.
Say, I'm not going to support this behavior.
Right. I think I do wonder, too, with how our situation was handled, how much do people know? Because the attempt to silence us was pretty strong. And our beef with the church was actually relatively minor before they blew it up. So I do wonder how many people are sitting in those churches have no idea the kind of things that are happening outside, you know, outside the actual service that's happening on Sunday mornings.
I mean, I can tell you that of the folks who have listened so far,
yeah,
who are still attending, there have been a lot of people who are like, I had no idea.
Right.
I had no idea. And even I'll tell you, like in my conversation with some friends of mine who I was talking to you about before we started recording, who are still in leadership positions at a local vineyard church. I will leave them nameless.
Yeah.
But because I love them. But I know that they weren't even aware of some of the internal things that were happening that directly affect them. Like, there are a lot of pastors within the vineyard who have no idea the true implications of the bylaws that they were just basically pushed to sign off on by May 1st. So they sign off on bylaws that aren't even finished yet.
No, here, sign this check before I put the amount in the thing. My God.
Exactly.
That's scary.
Very. And so there are chunks of it that are written, but incredibly vague. And then there are sections that are basically like TBD that are not written yet. And yet they were asked to sign off on this policy packet. And what they don't realize, though, is that they have, in effect, signed off on the fact that the national branch, if as a local pastor, if you make them angry, they can remove you. They can pull your ordination now. So they can remove that local pastor from leadership, and they can put anyone into that vacancy that they want, including themselves, if they wanted to. And that would give them immediate access to the church, the assets, the funds, everything.
Boy.
And there are a lot of pastors who were all too happy just to sign off on it because they're like, just trust us. And they're like, okay.
Right. And right. Like, we're good people. I mean, that's what we did. We trusted them.
Right.
Here's all my trauma.
Right? I mean, if you're going to trust anyone, you're going to trust the church, right?
Right. You're going to trust your pastor who loves you.
Yeah. Until they do something horrific and all of a sudden you're on the out. You know?
Right. And you're left picking up the pieces and all your friends are wondering, why isn't your husband on stage anymore?
Yeah.
Because he was my favorite worship leader. Where are you guys?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm crying in my basement.
Right. And that's the thing that's been a consistent theme here is that they like to control the narrative. And so for a lot of folks like yourself, you know, this podcast has been an opportunity to, for the first time in a lot of cases, tell their side of the story. Like, no, that's not actually what happened. A good example of this is there was a national conference. Gosh, I don't know when exactly. Could have been a couple of years ago. Point being that Bert Wagoner, who used to be national director, mm-hmm. And it seems like he was pretty well liked all around. Did not attend. And he didn't attend because he did not agree with the direction that they're heading as a movement. But Jay told everybody that he was sick, and that's why he didn't attend the conference until people started to see pictures of him fishing. And they're wait, Bert looks okay. He looks like he's fishing, you know.
Looks like he's having a grand old time.
Yeah. But because they've so tightly controlled that narrative, right, you know, people are just kind of like, oh, he was sick. That's why he wasn't there. And so, like, you know, for a lot of folks listening to this podcast, that'll be the first time they hear the truth. Like, no, he wasn't sick at all. He intentionally didn't attend. You know?
As a form of protest. Yeah.
And so maybe you guys should kind of seek to understand why that is and start asking questions. And right, like, again, it needs to be led by the larger churches. It's not going to be enough because they can just do what they've done to Ann Arbor. They just kicked Ann Arbor out of the Vineyard completely, disassociated them because lead pastor there sent a letter to the national office and said, I think you guys really screwed up in Duluth. You need to do X, Y, and Z, which, by the way, all the things that they were asking for were things that were mentioned in the report as suggestions.
Interesting.
They did go a little heavy-handed with the, and Jay needs to step down and the entire whatever. But not that I disagree with that. Like, hey, you know, that's your right as someone, you know, like it's your right to be able to say like, hey, this national leader did not do what I felt
like.
Well,
and if you're part of the family, right, you should have a say in how the family gets. I mean, I don't mean like the mafia family, but I mean like as the, you know, if you're part of the Vineyard, you have a right to say that, I would think. But it sounds like they said, we don't like what you did. And so Jay said, get out.
No, what happened was, so they sent this letter and they said, until these actions are taken, we're going to withhold our 3%. And then I don't know that there was any kind of conversation between the two that happened after that. But very shortly after that letter was sent, the Vineyard announced that they were no longer a part of the Vineyard.
Interesting.
Yeah, just kicked them right on out.
Well, I hope that Ann Arbor holds their chin up, that they did the right thing.
I think they are. I think they are. And I think there's a lot of, because a lot of the pastors I've spoken with are now former Vineyard pastors whose churches have survived and in some cases thrived as a result of leaving the movement. And so, and I know for a fact that there's a little conference. I shouldn't say a little conference. It could have been a big conference. I don't know. But there was a conference this last year in the spring, where a lot of now former Vineyard pastors sort of met and got a chance to speak with one another and kind of share their stories. And so there's some sort of, you know, almost like a family network that has resulted out of this.
Right.
So, you know, so anyway, last thoughts though, anything that, maybe that you didn't mention that you feel is important for folks to know that you want to put on record?
You know, I think we got most of it. I think the thing that happened to us that was so strange was just the people, like the middle leadership folk, right? They're really good people and they were trying really hard to help people who are struggling. And they were really put in a bad position. Like this woman that I talked to that reported me up the chain has no idea that she started an avalanche that like collapsed a huge chunk of my life, and she didn't do anything wrong, right? And I think, I guess I'm just glad that I don't have any blood on my hands, and I feel really badly for the people who don't see what's happening.
Yeah. Yeah, and to put it, somebody else said this, so I can't even take credit for it. It may have been Brian Metzger, I can't remember, but they said, if only Vineyard acted with as much fervor, you know, when it came to allegations of abuse as they do for these sort of menial situations that they just sort of clamp down on.
Right.
Then right, perhaps they wouldn't have as many problems as they do. So,
yeah, it definitely felt very like we're the controlling of the narrative. Right. Like, and that, I don't know, it just is not right.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on. I know, you know, obviously this is not easy to talk about, and to kind of reopen these wounds that still exist. But, you know, again, just appreciate so much your courage to come on and kind of share your story. And also, like, I know it will be highly beneficial to folks listening out there. So if there's anybody who hears this and has had their own experience, A, know that you're not alone, and B, know that, again, there is strength in numbers. And so the more people that come forward, the more pressure we can apply to actually make some meaningful change happen, hopefully.
Yeah, and thank you for doing this. Like, you know, it's been a long time, and every now and then I'm a little surprised, like Easter, right, that it's still there. And so having a place where you can come and see that this has happened, it's a systemic problem. It's not something that just happened to me, but there is a lot of healing that comes just from knowing, like, I don't know, just from what you're doing. So thank you.
I appreciate that. So thank you.
The views and experiences shared in this interview are those of the individual speaker and do not necessarily reflect the views of this podcast or its production team. All individuals mentioned are presumed innocent unless proven otherwise in a court of law. Allegations discussed in this interview are based on firsthand accounts and available documentation at the time of recording. This content is intended for educational and journalistic purposes and is protected under applicable free speech and press laws.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.